Hello and welcome to Lush Tums the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome.
And today we have our lovely guest, Alan, joining us. I had the privilege of meeting Alan a couple of years ago when his partner came along to pregnancy yoga, and then together they came to my antenatal education prepare for birth and baby course. It was a delight to meet you then, Alan, and I'm delighted to have you on the show to talk about your fertility journey and how that all unfolded for you. So without further ado, welcome, Alan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, thank you for giving us your time. So where do you want to start with this one, Alan? Like maybe right back at the beginning for you?
Yeah, maybe at the beginning. It's a long old journey. So it involves, you know, kind of fertility issues and then IVF and then a home birth. And there's somewhere along the line, there was a mental breakdown on my part in there as well. So it's a long old journey. But I kind of went through the other day and wrote a timeline for myself there was so much that happened. So just to kind of make sure that I was prepared for this and to talk through. But yeah, so I guess it kind of started, it was either late 2020, is that right? Yeah, about late 2020, I think, when we first started trying. And kind of at the same time, we were looking to buy our first house as well. So my wife, Lucy, I think she's been on the podcast. I think that episode would have come out by the time this one comes out, isn't it? So Lucy is my wife. She's been on the podcast. And kind of, so we started trying about late 2020, and then we bought our house, moved in around, I think it was about August 2021. And at that point, kind of nothing had happened in terms of conception. Nothing was happening. And it hadn't been that kind of year period that I know a lot of people look for. But Lucy was saying that, you know, should we just try this fertility MOT? There's this clinic in Hove called Agora, who are great. So big up Agora. So let's just do this fertility MOT thing, just because it's a private thing and it's not through the NHS. So we might as well just do it. But obviously it was in the middle of, it was second, I think the second lockdown and maybe just started at this point. So a lot of it was remote. Meetings were kind of virtual and stuff like that. So part of it was that I had to provide a semen sample, but I had to do that remotely, which basically meant that they would send out to me a kind of slide that, and then I would download an app onto my phone and then kind of put the camera on the put my sample in a normal tube and then kind of tip the tube onto the slide and then put my phone over the slide and then on the app press record, and it would, you know, see, it would kind of count sperm.
Wow.
Yes. which is like great that technology exists, but then when it comes back and says you've got like little to no sperm, it's not the best way of finding out, to be honest, because immediately you've got questions. And the next time you got an appointment is kind of 10-12 days away, and it's a virtual appointment, and that kind of 10-12 days you're just like in a horrible place, and kind of you're desperately wanting questions. You don't really, I've never wanted to ever Google anything, because like kind of beware of Dr. Google kind of thing, and I kind of hate all that. So I kind of stopped myself from doing that. But at the same time, I still had loads of questions that I wanted answering. I was still kind of panicking what it meant. I did a couple more and they kind of all came out the same result. So we eventually had our online meeting, And kind of Lucy had been doing tests as well, and they were all fine, they were all great. So it became apparent that kind of I was the quote unquote problem. And then it kind of at that point it became apparent that obviously fertility issues are obviously awful, and there's still a lot to be learned about them. But on the male side, if there's fertility, because I guess from a, you know, having kids' point of view, in terms of the actual act of conception, the men are very much kind of point and shoot, you know. You have one job, it's point and shoot, and then the kind of female body takes care of the rest. So there's a lot more, I guess, to go wrong with the female body, and therefore there's been a lot of research into it, which is great. And there's not been as much on the male side, and consequently there's just like, it turns out very, very few male fertility specialists that just exist. And so on our first kind of appointment, it was a little bit like, oh, okay. This doesn't happen that often. But luckily, Agora had a male fertility specialist come down from London once a month, which is, as it turns out, really unusual that that's the case. Like most kind of places don't really have access to a male fertility specialist. So then when he was next available, we met with him. I think it was coming out of lockdown by this point, or it counted as one of those exceptions that you could go in person to, kind of a health exemption. So then he kind of, you know, he kind of examined me, did some fondling, and then he kind of said, yeah, you know, I reckon you've got sperm. I just don't think it can come out for whatever reason. And then I was just like, you know, okay, that's good. I mean, it's not good that it can't come out, but you know, if he's right that I do have sperm, at least it means that, you know, IVF is on the table. That was kind of positive. Then on, I remember on the way back from that, that car journey back home, we chatted to Lucy's sister, younger sister, who we're both unbelievably close with. After Lucy and my son, she's like my favorite person in the world. I love her to pieces. She's like a little sister of myself. And she has also always had really, like, well, she's had severe PCOS, and she never thought she could have kids. And so she was kind of our person when it came to talking about fertility issues. And then on that same day that we found out that, you know, that I probably had sperm. We didn't find out, but the guess was that I had sperm and that there was a way forward. We've actually found out that Lucy's sister had got pregnant with her husband, which was amazing news. But like, it's so strange, because my immediate emotion was like heartbreak, because she was our person that we could chat to about this, and like suddenly it was gone. And like, I felt very alone, and that like I was a kind of a freak, I guess. And that like, biologically I was pointless, kind of from an evolutionary point of view, I was pointless. Which sucks, because, as I said, I love her to pieces, and I was so happy for her, because she never thought she could have kids. So her and her husband kind of, they never really used contraception, because they, you know, they didn't think they needed to, and she'd always wanted kids, but never thought it was possible. And then suddenly here comes this miracle kind of pregnancy. Yeah, I couldn't really be happy for them. And I kind of had to remove myself from all kind of, WhatsApp groups and stuff like that, and I just needed distance and stuff like that. And what was really sad for them as well is that like the rest of Lucy's family knew what we were going through as well, and therefore their reaction to Lucy's sister getting pregnant was kind of tempered. Yeah. and we didn't even think of that until we went on holiday with them last year or the year before, and then they started talking about that, and I was like, oh god, of course, like, I'm so sorry. That so I knew that my reaction and Lucy's reaction was tempered, and then I did message saying, I'm really happy for you, but I need to step away for a little bit. But like, it didn't even occur to me that everyone else's reaction was also kind of tempered because of it, and they were like, yeah, we didn't get that joy And I feel so bad because, and that's the thing with kind of fertility issues, is it doesn't just affect you, kind of it's, yeah, it kind of seeps out and affects other people, and yeah, it's crap. So yeah, so that kind of happened right in the middle. I was also kind of coming off the back of what turns out a kind of year-long mental breakdown, a kind of depression and anxiety, and I'd only I think I'd only just started seeing a therapist, or maybe I hadn't at that point. And it shouldn't have taken me so long to start, because Lucy, my wife, is actually a psychotherapist, and she was kind of pushing for it, and I was kind of saying, no, you know, like, you know, there are people worse off than me. Like, I'd just be taking the space from someone else who needed it more than me, and all of that, which is kind of rubbish. And I've kind of since realized that therapy isn't just, you know, if you've got a problem and it fixes it, it's a good maintenance thing as well. So like, I was in a really kind of rubbish place at the time. It's not really anything I'd wish upon anyone, really, that kind of that. And I felt so lonely, and I was keeping myself away. And like, there'd be people that would say, oh, you know, have you read this, or have you spoken to this person, or have you listened to this? And I'd be like, no, I don't really want to. I don't want to hear about it from other people. So like, hopefully if there's anyone listening to this that this applies to, like, hopefully it's helpful, but also at the same time, I understand why maybe you wouldn't want to listen to it as well. Kind of, I was very much in that mindset, but then I would flip, like, to be like, oh, okay, I'm going to do loads of research. And then like, and I'd do that for like half an hour, and then I'd be like back in my bunker kind of thing. So yeah. And then kind of, so with the, I think what happened then after we saw that male fertility specialist, I'm just kind of looking at my notes, because my God, a lot happened. I think he said that because kind of like there was a known problem, we could be handed back to the NHS. I think maybe it had been a year by this point, because these things kind of drag on quite a lot since we started trying. So I could kind of be handed back to the NHS with a known problem. So like, we started, obviously the NHS, they need their own kind of tests done. They can't just rely on like a private clinic's results. So then had to start doing loads of tests for the NHS, involving kind of samples. Like, luckily for us, we live right next to one of the NHS fertility specialists of the kind of South Coast, which is really nice. But even then, obviously the NHS are so overworked and underfunded that they only have their fertility clinic open one afternoon a week, and everyone's desperately trying to get an appointment in that time. So again, these things drag on quite a lot. And then obviously when you submit a sample that isn't done there, it gets sent up to, I think it was St. George's in London to done. So like, all that kind of takes a while. And we got a result back saying something along the lines of one of my hormone levels was slightly under the kind of normal, or what they deem a kind of acceptable range. And like slightly under, like, and because of that, I was then being put on a waiting list to do more tests to find out why that was low, and whether that was something that was going to affect IVF. And that was obviously heartbreaking again, because this was something that was completely separate to, or what, you know, we thought was completely separate to what we were going through. And then to find that, you know, we thought like, okay, this is the process. And when you're kind of going through NHS and then doing a little bit of private stuff as well, you've got to be the real kind of cheerleader for yourself. You've got to be the admin, you know, king and queen. You've got to sort it all out. You've got to align it. And so we'd kind of just worked out kind of what the pathway was. And then to be found out that there was something else now that, you know, and then going on the waiting list. And, you know, I've heard of people who've been on a waiting list for like 2 years. And so that really sucked. So I was kind of confused as well. And I didn't know why that this was the case. And does this actually really affect, you know, ability to have IVF and stuff like that? So I think eventually, like 2 or 3 months gone past, and we just booked in another meeting with the male fertility specialist at Agora, and we saw him, and he was like, oh yeah, don't worry about the hormone thing, that's nothing, like our range is much, much wider than that for what's an acceptable hormone level. It's just the NHS isn't. Because I know, obviously, it's public funding, so they've got to rely on like who's got the best chance, I guess, in order for it to be a return on investment, I guess. Whereas private clinics obviously don't have to worry about that. And he said that that's a kind of red herring anyway. I don't think that's the issue. So he had another fondle. And then he was like, I think that you don't have a vas deferens. I think you've probably got a cystic fibrosis gene somewhere in you. And then he explained to me that if you've got a cystic fibrosis gene or two, one on each chromosome, there can be a whole load of different symptoms arising because of that. So not cystic fibrosis itself, because in order to have cystic fibrosis, you need the exact same cystic fibrosis gene on each chromosome. And there, it turns out there are loads of different cystic fibrosis genes. But one of the kind of physiological things that can happen if you have one on each chromosome and they're different is that a man can be born without a vas deferens. So basically he said, he reckons I've got sperm, it just can't get out. There is no escape hatch for it. There is no tube at all.
For those that aren't familiar with that term,
it joins it with the rest of the semen and then out it goes. That's not a great vision, not a great visual there, but yeah,
necessary. But I mean, we, Claire and I are constantly complaining about the lack of understanding of female bodies from our education, and how many people don't really have a realistic idea of how it works. But I think actually the same can be true of men as well. You know, we do need to understand how our bodies work more. Yeah. You probably never thought about it before this journey, did you?
No, exactly. So like, I would speak to friends, like school friends and uni friends after the fact, and telling them about all of everything, kind of, you know, all the samples I had to give and stuff like that, and then what the eventual issue turned out to be. And they were like, well, didn't you work it out when nothing was coming out? And I was like, well, like they assume that because I have no sperm coming out, it means I've got nothing coming out at all. And the sperm basically goes into the semen, and it's the semen which is the whole liquid as a whole. So yeah, like there is that lack of knowledge, you know, assuming that just, you know, no sperm was coming out means nothing was coming out at all. So basically there was his kind of advice, this male fertility specialist's advice was, I think they're sperm. However, if you were to stay with NHS, like they would make you go through loads of these tests, which I think are a red herring. And you'd be on it for, you know, a year, 2 years waiting, nothing really happening. So his advice to us would be, I think skip a step and go under the knife basically and have sperm extraction. And then if there is sperm, which we think there is, then the sperm will be evidence of itself and you can go back onto the NHS. At that point, there is a known cause, like there's a known solution, and that's basically a way of fast tracking. So yeah, essentially that's what happened, is that I went for surgery at the clinic, and this guy kind of basically stuck a needle into my, which one was it, right one, I think, just in case you needed that visual. And but obviously at that point it was like we still didn't know. So then eventually when I came round, after I was sedated, not under anesthetic, but the sedation was enough, so I was kind of knocked out. When I came around afterwards, he stuck his head around the door afterwards and was like, yep, got loads of it. It's really good. It's really good quality. There's loads of it. And that was the first time like I knew for certain that like there was a chance, you know. And obviously like when you've just come out from being sedated, your mind is everywhere. So I think I just burst into tears with this poor like triage nurse kind of with her arm around me. Lucy was out waiting in the waiting area, and she went out to tell her and she started crying. And I remember just like had this flask of tea that like I was having as I was coming round, and just like grasping it and crying. And then apparently I was just telling the nurse that we had plans to go to the garden centre and buy a new plant. And she was like, I don't think you should go. Maybe you should just go back to bed and rest. And apparently I wouldn't stop going on about wanting to go to the garden centre. But I don't have any memory of that. But that's what happened, apparently. That was my reaction to being told that, you know, it was possible for me to have kids.
I think that's quite symbolic, actually, the idea of seeds and things growing and, you know, like, I can buy a plant now, like permission to...
Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm a lot deeper than I thought I was.
Yeah, I think you were. My subconscious is. Well, that was amazing news.
Yes, it was. And somewhere along the line, we also... another thing is as well, is like, because I had... cystic fibrosis, or it was kind of hypothesized that I had cystic fibrosis genes, I had to do a test which confirmed that I did. I had two different ones on each chromosome, so I don't have cystic fibrosis, I just have the presence of the genes. But then Lucy had to do one as well, because if she had the same ones, it would have affected IVF. I think the NHS, I don't quote me on this, but I think if she had the same ones, they wouldn't have done it. And if privately they would, but it would have be a, you know, there's a 25% chance, maybe, I'm trying to think about to biology GCSE, that my son would have had cystic fibrosis. So Lucy had to do that test as well, but she has no CF genes, which is great. So yeah, so then we could start the process from that point onwards. It was kind of quote unquote normal IVF. So it was ICSI IVF. So ICSI is when instead of normal IVF, where you kind of, they just put an egg and then some sperm in a petri dish and then just let them go on with it, maybe put on some Barry White. this one, the sperm, because they've gone to all this trouble, the sperm, ICSI IVF, the sperm is injected straight into the egg. They basically look at the sperm swimming around, isolate a really good one, and then in it goes. So Lucy did all that. She was on those hormones for ages. The pessaries, which she doesn't let up on. she always reminds me of the fact that she had to have pessaries every day, or twice a day, for what it was, like a month or something. And then the kind of egg extraction, and then at that point you do in ICSI IVF and normal IVF is obviously then when the sperm and the egg meet, and in ICSI obviously it's injected in. And so I think they'd got something like 16 eggs from Lucy, which is a nice number. And what usually happens is that, you know, maybe of the 16, maybe like 10 fertilize, and then they basically have to wait to see what turns into, I think it's blastocysts is the next stage, and then embryo is the stage after that. And then at kind of every stage a couple drop out, and you're left with maybe 2-3 kind of embryos that are ready for implantation and transfer. But of the 16, only 3 fertilized. So, and then again, we were just like, oh God, you know, something else has gone wrong. Because we knew that, like, at every stage, a couple of eggs drop out, or blastocysts or whatever stage they're at, drop out and die. And so we kind of had that 4 or 5 day period where we were just like crossing our fingers and just hoping that at least one would survive of them. But it turns out all 3 did, which was amazing. And we had these little survivors, these 3 little survivors, which was great. One of them had actually started hatching already out of the wall. And so that was then transferred into Lucy, and then it worked, which was great. And we're so lucky, because I know that at that point, depending on age, but at that point, it was basically a 50-50 chance for it to work for us. And you've got that 10-day period as well afterwards where you're just waiting until you can take a pregnancy test, basically. And when we took, on the 10th day, we took a pregnancy test, but it was one of those where instead of just saying pregnant or not pregnant, it had a line. But we didn't think it was a line at first. And then Lucy was just like studying it, like, you know, getting the kind of magnifying glass up to it. And then she thought she could see like the faintest line. And then, you know, it's about as faint a line as you could possibly get. It was like, it could conceivably have been not a line. It was that faint. So we're like, okay, well, we'll wait, 2 days as kind of advised, and then do another one. And then without like me knowing or without my knowledge, Lucy had found another pregnancy test, which was one the digital ones that just say pregnant or not pregnant. And she did it without knowing, and then surprised me with it saying pregnant on it, which was just amazing. But because like of everything, I think by this point, so I think we what was it like? So we had a kind of 8 months of trying before we did our fertility MOT, and then from the fertility MOT to Lucy getting pregnant was over a year. So it was essentially 2 years at this point, up leading up to this point. And like you're so guarded over that period, and like so many things have gone wrong kind of to get to this part that like you're just bracing yourself the whole time. And it's something that Lucy and I found, and we would change if we decide to have a second one, or and if it then works. And advice to also anyone else who's maybe gone through IVF to get to and it's worked to get to pregnancy stage is like it doesn't change if you then enjoy it and relax and enjoy it, because of so much that had gone wrong, we were so guarded. And like we never kind of really relaxed into the pregnancy, not until like maybe towards the end of the second trimester we did, but like up until that point we just like, okay, well, this is great, but something might go wrong, so let's just not get carried away, let's not get carried away. And we went, because when you do IVF you have a 6 or an 8 week scan as opposed to the 10 12 when you'll kind of naturally get pregnant, quote unquote. So we went to that, and it was like, yeah, really strong heartbeat, like chances of something going wrong is now like less than 1% or whatever it was. So even at that point we're like, oh God, yeah, great. And we could tell people, but you're still kind of like, yeah, I'm not gonna get carried away, I'm not gonna get carried away. But like you should get carried away, like it's amazing, like this has happened. And that's something that I learned throughout the pregnancy, is that like this amazing thing has happened, and just enjoy it, because you're not going to be able to go back and enjoy that again. That's like a time that's gone. And even if you go on to have a second kid, like that pregnancy is going to be different from the first pregnancy. Like you're never going to enjoy that first pregnancy ever again. So yeah, that's something that looking back that kind of I wish I'd done differently. But oh, at the same time, it's kind of understandable the position we're in, I think. Yeah.
Hindsight is a beautiful thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and a cruel thing.
Yeah.
And trying to guard your heart, that thing where it could all go away, that sort of instinct to protect yourself somehow. But it, instead of, I don't think, I mean, I can't really comment, but I don't think protecting yourself by stopping yourself from feeling joy would make the loss any less painful.
No.
So it's kind of like you're stealing from yourself with no benefit as well. If the worst does happen, that's not gonna, guarding yourself isn't gonna make it any better. But all it's done is steal your joy. It's fear. Fear is kind of this cloud stopping you from embracing the love, embracing the joy. But I think it's very human. I think nearly everyone would have reacted the same way you did. But I love the fact that maybe someone could listen to this and go, perhaps I can experience joy. Maybe I can just have that faith. I've had faith all the way along. The reason I've done this is because I believe ultimately I'm going to end up with a baby. Otherwise, you wouldn't bother, would you? You wouldn't do it. And can you allow that faith to just permeate a little bit more, and with each stage in, embrace the joy?
Yeah, it's a really good point, because like the stealing yourself is an evolutionary thing, right? Like, because if you think about our ancestors, if they were walking past a bush and it rustled, you would rather think there was a predator and be wrong but run away than think, oh, it's probably nothing, and then a predator jumps out and eats you. So like it's a natural thing, but at the same time you're right that if you allow yourself to experience the joy of it and then you do lose it, like You didn't lose it because of the joy that you experienced, and it doesn't change anything in terms of the pain.
100%.
Allow yourself to feel that joy.
I think that's a really powerful message for everyone that's pregnant, regardless how they got to that point in their journey. I think there's this little bit where we all hold ourselves back from feeling the joy because of the fear. But you're absolutely right, and I love that you've spoken about that, Alan. Thank you.
No, yeah, I think it's important, and you know, if we do have a second one, then that is something that I will look to take into that. So yeah, hopefully anyone listening, they'll get that as well. So after that point, it was kind of a normal pregnancy, I guess. And then we kind of fast forward to start the third trimester, where we were recommended this antenatal group called Lush Tums.
Yay.
I'm getting paid for this, right? I'm on commission. Claire M. You're both Claire M. Claire M.A. Lucy Nicol. She recommended you to us and your antenatal group. So we went to that, and I think in your first, in the first class, is it a class? Yeah, I guess it's class. You call it, yeah. You kind of mentioned about, I think one of the things was like, how do you visualize your birth? And I think everyone in it was like, yeah, go to a hospital, you know, try and avoid interventions, but you know, trust modern medicine if needed. And then you talked about, you know, like, you know, whether it's a home birth or a hospital birth. And Lucy immediately was like, home birth, you know, and like it, like we talked about it on the car journey home. And it was nothing, it was something we just hadn't even thought was a possibility. Like we just didn't, I mean, like we knew that like people had home births, but we were just like, you know, oh, I don't know, maybe like someone who lives out in the sticks, or, you know, I don't know, or someone who's like got complete distrust of modern medicine, mistrust of modern medicine, which we don't, like, you know. We're not exactly like fans of Big Pharma or anything, but you know, we like to trust modern medicine.
And it when had it's got there you, for us. It had got you so far, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Medicine was in your exactly. back pocket a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If it wasn't for modern science, then we wouldn't have a kid. But Lucy was like, you know, it's not like I like going into hospital or anything. Like, I think maybe this home birth thing is something we should consider. And I came, I came into it like my feeling was just that I just wanted Lucy to have the birth that she wanted to have, because like I'd read the statistics and all of that, and statistically, if the kind of mum is comfortable, or as comfortable as she can be, I guess, when you're in the process of giving birth, but then like the birth is likely to go better. And you know, yeah. with less interventions and all of that. So my mind was just like, well, I just want Lucy to kind of, you know, feel comfortable. I want her to have the birth that she wants. For me, like, I didn't really mind whether it was in a hospital, you know, whether it was C-section if it had to be. So I'm a C-section baby. Like if that's what it had to be, then that's what it had to be. As long as kind of Lucy was on board with it, because she's the one that's actively giving birth and I'm kind of a bystander. So yeah, we kind of like looked into home birth and started reading loads of papers on it. And it turns out there's actually quite a lot of papers published on it. So just as background, I'm a sports nutritionist and sports scientist essentially, and with a master's. So I'm really kind of, I put a lot of stock in like reading research. and it's weird because like I was quite happy to read research about this, but when it came to the male fertility stuff, I really wasn't. I wanted to, it was a completely different headspace. Like I wanted to bury myself away from all that. But with this, I was just like, okay, yeah, let's see what research has to say about it. And it turns out there's actually like a fair bit. And we were really encouraged about it at the time. In terms of, you know, the statistics, in terms of intervention rates being really low, it, you know, something like I can't remember statistics now, but like the vast majority, like the group of people giving birth is the lowest of those who want a home birth from the start. And even those who want a home birth and then eventually do go into hospital still have a lower intervention rate than people that were always going to go into hospital from the start.
I'm really pleased you got into the numbers and the data. That's really, really impressive.
I'm a big data boy. Yeah, big data boy. Love it. Yeah, so like really encouraged by that. The thing is, like, obviously, and then, you know, some interventions can't be helped. Like they're there for a reason. They're important. But also, like, the more we were kind of heard about it, heard anecdotal stuff, the more Lucy and I started seeing the birth process in the hospital as kind of a conveyor belt a little bit, which isn't to put down, you know, midwives or any or paediatricians or anything like that. They do an amazing job and they're not the enemy at all for us here. And I think like there were times where we had to butt heads a little bit in order to push through that we wanted a home birth with no interventions and no checks or anything like that. And so there were times where kind of I almost had to be a middleman between midwives and Lucy and just be like, you're not the enemy here. We think you're amazing. It's just that we don't really want any of it. But yeah, so we started seeing, and you know, because, you know, they've got loads of people coming into hospital, they might need the beds for something else if nothing's happening by a certain point, which is understandable, right? Because, you know, if you go into labor at home and then you're taken into hospital, it's a change of environment and your hormones change, and the what's the love hormone,
oxytocin
drops, right?
Yeah.
So it's not unusual for contractions to like stop or at least become less frequent if you go into hospital, because it's suddenly a really clinical place. And so it's not unusual then, as it turns out from the research and from what you were saying in the groups as well, for it just to slow down completely when you go to hospital. And at that point, like, the hospital, obviously they've got stuff they need to do. You know, they're busy. It's not an easy job. They've probably got other people coming in. So if nothing happens after a certain while, they'll start with interventions. And that's just like not something Lucy wanted at all. And I was with that completely. So yeah, we eventually, and at one point, I think in the third trimester as well, we had to go into hospital for a checkup. I think Lucy was feeling a bit dizzy on a walk and started getting blurry vision in one eye, which I think can be a sign of preeclampsia, right? I think. And it wasn't, it was fine. I think Lucy's really tall and she's got poor blood circulation, and it turns out that's all it was. But so we went into hospital just for a check, and everything was fine. But immediately Lucy was like, yeah, no, I'm not giving birth in the hospital unless I absolutely have to. But at the same time, we're probably 20 minutes on a good day drive away from the nearest hospital. And so there's an element of risk there if you're choosing a home birth. So we decided, and again, like, this is not something we'd heard of until going to Lush Tums, we decided to get a doula. And so we spoke to a few and eventually settled on Sarah, who is just amazing. Like, again, doulas are not cheap. So then Lucy and I decided from the outset, it's not exactly like we're flushed with cash, but we decided, like, when it comes to the birth, like, we're not going to leave anything to chance, really, a little bit. And if it costs, then it costs. And that's just something we're going to have to get over and then just work harder afterwards to make up for. So, yeah, doulas aren't cheap. But, like, if you can stretch to it, I think they're incredible, especially for a home birth.
Did you do your research around some stats and data on the benefits of having a doula? What did you discover?
I can't remember the specifics now, but... I think, like, again, intervention rates go down, don't they? And I think from memory, intervention rates go right down, and I think the amount of births that start off at home and go into hospital also go down as well, which definitely was the case with us. So we'll kind of come to that. But what is the kind of stats behind it?
I think you've got like a 60% less chance of having any medical interventions if you've got a doula on board. I think it lowers your chances of having a cesarean by a further 50%. And then there's a whole other raft of stats around all the other kinds of interventions that get lowered by 40% or 30%. So, yeah, Michel Odon, a famous French obstetrician, famously said, if having a doula was as simple as administering a drug, it would be unethical not to give it to everybody.
They're amazing people, just like, and midwives, like all the ones that we came across anyway, are amazing people as well, but they've also got a job to do. Whereas the doula is 100% yours, like 100% yours. And midwives, like, as much as they're amazing people, also employed by NHS or by the hospital. And therefore, there is the things like risk and litigation risk and stuff like that that they've got to mitigate for, whereas the doula doesn't. And so they're just yours. They're like 100% yours. They're amazing. Like, if you can stretch to it, it's so worthwhile, especially for a home birth, because when Lucy went into labor, it took a while. Like, she was in labor for a while, and also because also Lucy didn't really want any drugs, any kind of painkilling drugs. She had gas and air for about half an hour and then stopped because, like, she said it was like it was affecting her being able to breathe, like hypnobirthing. It was kind of affecting that and affecting the noises she could make. So the rest of the time it was just the birth pool, which we had borrowed off another doula actually. So even this doula that we spoke to and decided not to go with, she still lent us her birth pool. Like, it's a lovely, lovely group of people, lovely community. Even though we decided to go with someone else, she still was just like, yeah, borrow my birth pool, like, no problem. So Lucy, we were watching Taskmaster, and Lucy went into labor during that, which I guess is like, it's a really funny show, so you're probably at your most relaxed when you're like, you're watching a funny show and stuff like that, so I guess that's not really a surprise. And then it really ramped up super quick from that point. And it was just like, oh, here we go. Like, it's now. Like, and so I remember like ringing the midwives, and then ringing Sarah, and then ringing back when they were, was it three contractions every 5 minutes, I think. And then so everyone coming around, and then immediately I was like, right, I've got to fill this birth pool up. Like running between filling the birth pool up and then going running upstairs to check Lucy was okay, like counting contractions and stuff like that. But the birth pool, you kind of got a hose and then an attachment to attach to your tap. But the attachment on our tap couldn't stand the water pressure, so it just kept breaking off. So I was having to like basically fill up tubs of like buckets of water and then run to the birth pool and then come back and then like try and get to 37 degrees or 38 degrees, like trying to nail that temperature whilst filling a birth pool up from empty with just using buckets. And then Sarah turned up and she's like, yeah, I'll help you. And so we had like two of us like running back and forth between the taps, like filling up this birth pool while like these noises are coming from upstairs. And then like Lucy kind of she made her way downstairs, midwife turned up, and the midwife was straight away like, oh yeah, this is ramped up quick, I think it's. And Lucy had already kind of really quickly got to the stage where she was saying like, oh, I don't think I can do this, which is like, from what we read and from what we heard from you, is like the classic sign that it's quite near. Because you're I think, is it your hormones check, your oxytocin turns into like goes down, adrenaline goes up, is
Oh
that
yeah,
right?
so you're talking about transition. So you thought you were in
Yes.
transition.
Yeah.
And was she?
So, no. So the midwife was like, the first midwife was like, oh yeah, I reckon. And this was like maybe 1, 2 in the morning, was like, oh, I reckon there'll be a baby here by 5. And then 8 a.m. turned up, and the midwife had to switch over. The shift had ended. And like, it was, at this point, I think like the contractions being like, three every five, is it three every five,
Three
which
and
is,
every
or was it
10.
three every 10? That's it. Three every 10. Yeah. Three every five would be crazy. Three every 10, had started from basically, I think 11:30 PM, maybe midnighty. So it'd been about 8 hours, which is not like, crazy long for a first birth, as we all kind of read up about. So the midwife changed over, and then a little bit after that, Lucy was like, oh, I think I just felt down. I think I can feel the head. All the while I was still like running in between, because midwives are like the water has to be 38. It has to be 38. Like, can't be any different. And like, we know the reason. Like, if that's the water's too cold, it can make the baby, when it comes out, take a breath. And then it's just water and stuff like that. So we know the reasons it has to be like the body temperature water. So I was like really on it. And I was also, you know, I had my little fishing net, like surreptitiously fishing poo out of the water, which I didn't tell Lucy about until afterwards. Lucy was like, oh, did you see any of the poo? Because it was, I was getting Sarah to fish them out. And I was like, no, it was me fishing them out. So that's just something to be aware of if you go down this line.
That would, of course, happen in any setting, if you're having a vaginal birth in a hospital bed or in a water, in the water in a in hospital.
It's a good sign.
Midwives are usually the ones that deal with it, but that it's nice that you had a very active
Part of the birth plan was that Lucy basically didn't want Lucy didn't really want like a midwife standing over her, and so the midwife was basically sitting in the kitchen the whole time while this was happening in the front room. So the midwife was only coming in to like every so often, and really kind of only like really not that often, because we'd also said no to all the checks and like the vaginal examinations and the dilations and stuff like that. We'd said no to that, and so it was like every few hours just to monitor heartbeat, and that was it really. So yeah, it was the poo fishing was incumbent on me and Sarah, but it's fine, you know, I was okay with that. So Lucy said that she could feel the head, so that's when like the second midwife was then called, the baby's midwife was called. But then like it still carried dragging on. And then I remember it was around kind of midday, the midwife started saying to me that they were getting a bit worried, which is the absolute last thing that I wanted to hear, because one of the reasons we got a doula is that I knew that I was probably going to be a mess during the whole of this, and that like having had problems with mental health before and having seen a therapist and all this like part of the doula was like stealing myself for that. I was like, this is, you know, this is prep, we need this because like we're going to need the help. And so they were saying that Lucy hadn't been for a wee in since like the night before, like 11 p.m. or so, or whatever, and that they think that her bladder was starting to get in the way. And that if like there was one push and the baby's head come out, that it could lead to a really like big bleed, basically like a worrying bleed. And so I was like, oh God, you know, great. I understand why they were telling me that. I didn't really want to hear it. Obviously I didn't want to hear it, but you kind of have to. So at that point, I was starting to think, oh, maybe we should just go into the hospital here. Like, because if you start with a home birth and then you get taken into hospital, you get taken straight in to A&E. You don't have to go through reception or anything like that.
You get straight into your birthing room, isn't
yeah.
it? You don't go into like the triage area where they, you know, offer vaginal examinations to see if you're pregnant or not. I saw that on Instagram yesterday, is like vagina passport control, which I thought was hilarious. And it's like, well, you miss that if you plan a home birth, you just get straight into your room, which is a huge advantage of planning a home birth over a hospital birth.
So it sounds like this was a moment, you know, this was something you'd done every plan you possibly could to try and avoid, like having this conversation or having this sort of scenario. When you're faced with it, how were you feeling? How did you respond?
Well, this was the reason we had a doula, because I was like, oh, let's just go to hospital. Let's get this done. Like, it's taken so long. The midwife's telling me that they're worried now. And it's so weird because at that point you don't have a baby. So like my mindset was still like, protect Lucy. Like, Lucy is the one I need to protect because the baby's not born yet. I mean, obviously, there's a big debate over what, like, when's the baby alive and all of that. But like that, I hadn't seen it. You know, it was just a thing in Lucy's belly that would kick occasionally, like, and you would hear its heartbeat and stuff like that. So at that point, my mindset was still like, Lucy must be protected. Like, So I was like, just let's go to hospital. Let's make sure, let's just get it over and done with, like maybe C-section, you know. And so I started telling Lucy that. I was like, I'd come over to her and she'd be on all fours in the birthing pool. And I would just kind of like kneel down and say, like, my love, I think maybe let's just go to the hospital here. Let's maybe just get C-section. Let's get it done. And like Lucy was like, what? No, what's wrong? Why? What's wrong? And this is why we had the doula, because Sarah was straight away in like, no, okay, like, let's just see how it goes. Carry on breathing for a bit longer. And she was so good at like stepping in and mitigating me and my panic and sticking, because like she'd seen there and done it, like been there, done it and seen everything. And so she was like sticking to the birth plan. She was like, no, this is fine. We can still do this. It's fine. There are ways around it. Like, let's just carry on. You can do this, Lucy. And I was like, maybe we should just go to hospital. So like, yeah, like she was great, like amazing. And if we hadn't have had Sarah there, if we hadn't had the doula there, like we definitely would have gone to hospital and probably maybe had a cesarean birth. Yeah, because at this point it had been 12 hours, I think. And like Lucy had been at the same stage that they estimated since, yeah, something like 4 a.m., something like that. So like the baby had been upside down in the birth canal. Well, upside down anyway, but like been in the birth canal basically for all that time. Mm-hmm. And basically, so in the end, like Sarah was really good at kind of negotiating, and she was like, okay, well, why don't, Lucy, you try getting out and going for a wee, and then if it doesn't happen, then you can have a catheter and help like remove the urine from the bladder, and then that's that done. And like, that's something we can do here. We don't have to go to the hospital for that, but let's just wait and see if you can go to the toilet first. And so Lucy was like, okay. And then so we like stayed in the pool for a bit longer. At this point, I think I had to go out for a walk, like, which I felt really bad about at the time. And like, again, it's not something I would have done if we hadn't had a doula. But I knew that because like we could basically take turns with Lucy, and then I just needed to get out, because like, the whole point of the home birth for Lucy is that it was in a safe space for her. She didn't really like hospitals. She didn't feel safe there. She felt safe at home. And like, that's great. But like, it's also my safe space. But at that point, my safe space was no longer my safe space. Like, I was full on panicking. I was having the worst time. I cannot tell you, I was having the worst time. So I had to go out for a walk. And
sometimes that is like, the best thing, though. Sometimes yeah. That is the best thing, just to give her some space and you some space. And I don't think people talk about that enough. And like you just said, you felt really guilty. Mm. And actually, hopefully people coming up behind you planning their births will hear this and be like, okay, there might be a moment where me as the birth partner needs to step outside, get a breath of fresh air, grab a coffee, get a sandwich, go for a wee. And actually the birthing lady, that might be the moment things shift and change and happy days, you know. So
yeah,
everything has a place, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, because thinking about it afterwards, I suppose it's no real different, like if you're in a hospital, like popping down to the cafe to get a coffee or something like that, you know.
Exactly.
I was only like 15-20 minutes. I went around the block twice, I think. But I knew that I could, because Sarah was there, and the midwives were like, yeah, we'll call you if anything happens. It's fine. We've got your number. And I just needed to, like, I cannot tell you how much I needed to get out, because my safe space was no longer safe.
Yeah. Bit of re-regulation time.
Exactly. And my hope was that I'd be out and then I'd get a call and like, it's happening, come back. But that didn't happen. So I came back, and then eventually Lucy was like, okay, I'm going to try going to the toilet. And so she walked upstairs, like the birthing pool was in the living room downstairs. So she walked upstairs. And then as soon as she sat on the toilet, she's like, oh my God, I think the head's come out. And basically it was the change of position, like kind of the moving up the stairs. Had just kind of maybe just like dislodged or changed the kind of access the other way around, the exit. Something like that. Maybe a little bit of wee came out and the bladder could kind of got a bit smaller. And then suddenly it was like, oh, it's happening, it's happening. And so like Lucy got off the toilet and was just on all fours on the landing, and she was like, I don't want to give birth on the landing. And it was all like panic stations. And then like I was like, oh my god, I've got to fill up the birth pool again. And like I was straight down, like, oh no, it's gone down to 36.5. And trying to fill up the birth pool and make sure it's at the right temperature. And then Lucy was like, Alan, it's happening, get up here. And so I abandoned the birth pool. And then like, so we had like a midwife at Lucy's head and then a midwife at the rear, like watching what was happening. And it turns out the head wasn't out, it's just it was starting to crown. But to Lucy, apparently it felt like the full head came out. So so she was pushing and pushing, and it was coming further out each time with each contraction. And then Lucy was like, I don't want to give birth on the landing, can I go down to the birth pool? And the midwife was like, if you're going to the birth pool, it's got to be now. I think the next one the whole head's coming out. And so Lucy like ran downstairs and like, you know, like you say, don't get between the hippo and water. Like, and the midwives were like, is it 37 or 38? I can't remember which one it is. And I was like, no, it's 37.5. And they were like, oh, it's got to be 38. And then Lucy was like, get out of my way. And like charged into the water, got on all fours, had a contraction, and the whole head came out just like that. Like it was that close to like not being in the pool.
Amazing.
And then the next one, the shoulders came out, and then the rest of it came out, and that was it. And then we had our baby at home after a 14-hour labor at home, after IVF, after everything. Yeah, we had our baby, and there was a very, very small bleed, very, very small tear, but nothing that needed hospital, anything like that. We tried everything as kind of natural as possible. So in the kind of days afterwards, I would soak calendula flowers and then put that in a bath, so it was just warm water and calendula kind of water, and that like helped Lucy heal. The midwife was really understanding as well, and Lucy didn't really want to be stitched up, and she was just like, if you just do this, you don't need stitching up, it's not that bad. I cut the umbilical cord. We had the kind of the normal, so and kind of he latched pretty much straight away, which was great, and that helped the afterbirth. Like they'd left us to it for like 40 minutes maybe, just the three of us, and then they came back in to check Lucy, and they were like just to examine where the placenta was, and they were like, oh, it's knocking on the door, it's like ready to come out. So like I remember that Lucy squatting and then it going all over the carpet.
What were you thinking and feeling in those moments where you finally much longed for a little baby?
Yeah.
What was it like?
Disbelief, I think. So when Lucy got out of the pool with him, so Lucy's quite tall. So I think she had a normal length umbilical cord, but on her it was quite short. So like I remember her trying to hold him while she was climbing out, but then like almost being dragged along with her as she was climbing out. And then there's a picture of me, which I don't remember being taken, that I was holding him after the umbilical cord was cut, and he was just lying on me. And I don't remember it being taken, but I'm just like flat out on my back, just like I've got one arm around him and then the other arm is like splayed out. And I don't know, it must have been Sarah who took the picture, but I don't remember it being taken. And I think it was just like relief at that point. And I had that kind of immediate, I know not everyone gets this, but I had that immediate I love you like thing with him, and like you're mine, I must kind of protect you thing, which then like again, I don't think it's maybe, I don't know if this gets talked about, but like that kind of immediate bond doesn't always happen. And with me, like I had it straight away, but then it kind of, as the kind of realization of like, oh my god, this is really hard, kind of kicked in over the next 4 or 5 weeks, it kind of went. And it, because like at first it's a really transactional relationship, which I know is not putting a lot of emotion in it, but like they demand a lot, and then you do it, and then you know they scream and then cry and then feed and then sleep,
and you don't feel like you get much back, do you?
And you don't get much back. So like again, like the kind of, I had like a little plateau or dip in my like bonding with and kind of feelings towards him, but then like it ramps up again, and like afterwards, like I love him more than anything now. So yeah, like it was a weird kind of feeling straight afterwards of just like, I love you, but also like, oh my God, I'm tired, and shock as well, and then complete awe of Lucy as well, that she had done this, that she had like the whole thing from trying to facilitate MOT to like everything I went through to then IVF and then pregnancy and then home birth with no interventions, no painkillers, just the warm water. And she had gone through all of that and then delivered this like beautiful boy. Complete awe of her, like just a warrior. Like, I cannot believe that a human body can do that. It's incredible. But not just that, but as I said, everything before that as well.
So powerful. Oh, I've gone all tingly. You're giving me the goosebumps.
Do you think those few weeks afterwards, do you think, would you say you had is there such a thing as a typical fourth trimester? I'm wondering, hearing about all the things you went to through at the beginning of your journey to becoming a dad, and then how that may be impacted when you actually were a dad, when you're actually doing the care. You sort of mentioned that kind of plateau, or I suppose it's a process really of undergoing this change. I think women during the pregnancy, it's very physical, and there's brain changes that happen as you become a mother. And for a father, we don't really talk about that journey. Often it's a case of actually, as you kind of described, until you saw him, he was, this thing that kicked a little bit in Lucy every now and again. It wasn't like, this is my baby, this is my son, this is my, what it's all about. And then so that's actually a huge change, isn't it? Those first few weeks after he's there, you've gone from having one focus, which is protect and keep my wife safe, and look after her emotional needs, and try and drag myself along with it as well, to suddenly there's a little human I'm now got in my care, and my wife that I'm still protecting and wanting to keep safe and helping her along. That's massive. That's just massive under normal circumstances. And you had exceptionally challenging ones to begin with. Do you feel that that Do you feel that gave you more strength as you reached that? Do you feel like there was a lot of processing? What does any of
It's a
that
great
make sense?
question. Yeah, that's a really great question, because so for us it felt like pregnancy was like 2 years, because of like from starting to try to eventually having the kid, it was over 2 years in fact, all of that time. So it felt like pregnancy was going on forever. And so at that point, I realized actually in a Lush Tums thing that when well, I think we were talking about like what to do next after birth, I was like, oh my God, there is going to be a what's next. Like, I was so steeled for the actual birth itself. I wasn't prepared for the fact that after that, you're like off everyone goes, and now you've got a baby, and it's yours, and like this, you're now legally responsible for it. If something goes wrong with it, you're legally responsible for this thing that didn't exist 5 minutes ago, kind of thing. So I don't like it. Yeah, I think the fact of everything we went through did have an impact, because it actually like made me it, I was I think I oddly I was less prepared, like because it just felt like we'd been pregnant forever, and it kind of been the state that we were used to. So and then definitely like afterwards, so obviously Lucy had done that whole home birth, and so she needed to be in bed for like a week afterwards. And she would get out of bed to like go for her bath, and that was it, and then back into bed. And so I was doing everything else in the house, which is obviously understandable. I don't have a problem with that. But it did mean that I was like running around doing all the housework. I've now got really good at housework. That's definitely a talent that I've developed. Like I was doing everything, and so I would make sure that I had bonding times with him, skin on skin and all of that. And when Lucy would go for a bath, I would have him. And then even if Lucy wasn't going for a bath, she was just in bed sleeping or whatever, I would like make sure that I would have those bonding experiences with him. But he was always kind of just like asleep. And then if he woke up and started crying, it was very much like, okay, Lucy, here we go. Like he probably needs boob. So I don't know if this has answered your question really. It's kind of it's a really good question. I don't know. But I think, like, yeah, and also I only had 2 weeks of paternity leave as well, which is not enough. Like, it's absolutely not enough because the first 2 weeks is the baby's kind of attached to the mum. And like, as I said, like, I would make sure to have bonding with it and skin on skin with him. But like, still obviously very much that the baby doesn't realize it's outside the womb kind of thing that people say. Yeah, so it I don't know if I was that prepared. I think there came a point somewhere towards the end of the third trimester where I was like, okay, there is going to be a what next. I tend to catastrophize, so I was like, I don't want to think beyond the birth, because you know what, if something goes wrong, and it goes back to that thing that we were saying earlier, like, it's okay to not think like that because it doesn't affect if something actually does go wrong. And again, that's a learning going forward. So yeah, it was only towards the end of that that I was really like, okay, there is going to be a what next. And then, like, so like, yeah, housework wise, I had it nailed. Like, I was on top of all of that admin, but the rest of it, no, it's like, yeah. And I think that's probably where that kind of bonding with him dipped and plateaued, or plateaued. I wouldn't say dipped, maybe, but plateaued. Is because, like, you know, I was running around doing everything, and which is again how it should be, but like, I wasn't really, I didn't know how to bond with this thing yet. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Do you know, and maybe this might be for other people coming up behind you, or maybe for you guys yourselves, if you get to do this another time, that you know the doulas, a lot of them offer postnatal services.
Yeah, and we had that. Yeah,
You have
we had
that.
that, which was great.
But I
Yeah.
think we all need a lot more of it. Or, you know, or a lot of family that can come and bring all the food and do the cleaning and the housework, so that, you know, especially when the dads only have 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever paternity leave, that there's a lot more support for you both as a new little family, so that you've got that time to process and not have to worry about cooking and cleaning, really.
And that was something that actually you said in one of the last sessions that really stuck with us, is like, don't invite people over that you have to host, because like, you're just not going to do that. Like, you're not going to invite people over that can make their own cup of tea, like, in your house. And like, don't be suddenly like, right, can I get everyone a coffee? Can I get everyone a tea? Like, just don't do that. Just only invite the people over that can do that themselves. And then don't be shy upon saying, right, I think you need to go now. We need rest and we need quiet. Yeah.
You actually
Absolutely.
just quoted me word for word, Alan. Well done.
Yeah. Such a fantastic piece of advice. And you know, I'd also say as well, we live in a society where our value is measured against the tangible things you can do. So the fact that you were like, I'm rushing around and I'm doing all the things, that's what we're geared up to, you know, because if you're not doing all the things, then you're doing, and I'm air quoting, nothing. But of course, learning to just be and to let some things go so that you can be present is not something we actually learn or train for or prepare for, or it's even given value. And actually, it's really hard for people, especially, you know, if you've been through a real emotional journey. We know this is something we in our yoga classes we find that a lot of people really struggle with the relaxation at the end. Sometimes being still is hard, being quiet is hard, doing nothing, air quotes, is really, really hard. And so busyness in some ways can protect us from feeling those hard feelings or being there in the moment. But also the world celebrates that. So of course we're going to tick all the things, we're going to do all the stuff and, you know, look at the Immaculate Kitchen, Instagrammable, yes please, thank you very much, you know, leaving the plates in the sink and having a cuddle in your pajamas isn't valued in quite the same way, but my God, it should be.
Yeah. No, that resonates a lot, because I'm always someone who likes to keep busy. Maybe not the Instagram thing, but just the keeping busy, doing jobs, like ticking off the jobs. Yeah, I've done this, like, that's very much me. And yeah, learning to not do that. Like, for me, it took therapy to learn that it's not, you know, you can just not do that and it's fine. And you know, self-care is fine. Like, you don't always have to be on the go and busy.
Yeah, it's so true. So true. A really powerful message, I think, for everyone, actually. Brilliant. Wow, that was amazing, Alan. Thank you so much for your share. I think
Yeah,
that's
you're
going to be
welcome.
really helpful for people going on, in similar places and becoming parents. It's just been wonderful to listen to your journey. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure. And I would also say, if anyone is going through a really hard time with fertility issues, get a dog. Like, my God. She, my dog, Lyra is her name. She saved me. Like, I'm so grateful to her. Like, because we got her just, I think, just before we went to the fertility MOT. And so, like, she was old enough by the point that we were going that I realized there was something, quote unquote, wrong with me. That she was old enough to like go for walks and stuff like that and need training and interaction and stuff like that. And if it wasn't for her, I would have just sunk into a hole and stayed in bed. And but she, dogs hold you to account. You have to take them for a walk. You have to feed them and keep them watered and play with them and train them and interact with them and stuff like that and build a bond with them. So yeah, like I cannot recommend enough. Like she was a rock for me.
Oh, they do lift our oxytocin up as well, when we're hanging
Yes.
out with them, so that we genuinely feel better by patting them and connecting with them. It's a proper difference. But yeah, that's a great piece of advice. Is there any final bits of advice you'd want to share with anyone coming up
I
behind
think
you?
just like be like if you're having like as far as you're comfortable, if you're having stuff like I went through, especially on the male side, which is more unusual because there is less to go wrong, I guess. Like if, as far as you're comfortable, it's okay to be open with people because like I didn't for a while and it's so lonely. And then it, like I remember like going to a mate's wedding and just deciding like I'm just going to be open with my mates here and just say like this is what I'm going through. And it wasn't like they weren't like, oh, this is awkward, like we're at a wedding, like get the tone right, mate. It wasn't like that. It was they were so lovely and supportive. And that when we were lucky enough to then get pregnant, they were just so happy afterwards for me, which was great. And so, like, just as far as you're comfortable with, just like tell the people around you what's happening, because otherwise it's so lonely. And when we were lucky enough to then get pregnant, we didn't have that, oh my God, surprise, we're pregnant thing that you can drop on people. Like, we didn't have that, of course, because the people around us knew what we were going through. But it's worth missing out on that to have the people around you supporting you, because you're going to need like what we went through, you're going to need the people around you to support you.
And regardless of the outcome, they're going to be there for you as well. So, I love that. And there's something about the ability to be vulnerable with people, I think, makes a deeper connection. It allows for intimacy there, doesn't it? By being vulnerable, by showing your true self, your inner world, if you like, and allowing people into that. Then that makes a friendship like and bond and relationship like no other. And it kind of stops that isolation, but you have to be again brave enough to do that because fear can stop us from being vulnerable with people, and therefore cut off our intimacy with people as well. So I'm so pleased that you did that, and it absolutely warms my heart when people are able to show up for other people. For me, like, that's the best feeling in the world, and that would have been good for your friends as well as good for you. There's something about being able to be there for someone which it does us all good. It makes us all human, it makes us all connect, and I love that. I love that so much, and I've loved Alan. You've been so open and you've explained it all in such a personal and relatable way. I'm really pleased we got to have this conversation with you, and I'm really hoping so many people will feel comforted by the things you've been through and learn from your experience. And you're just really grateful and honored that you came to share it with us. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, me too. I used to be the kind of stereotypical male that didn't like talking, didn't like sharing, didn't like being vulnerable. And that's not a healthy way to be.
So we always finish our podcast with three questions. Claire, do you want to fire through them?
Sure. So from something you said earlier, I'm dying to know what we believe each baby brings, something special with them, a gift, or maybe a talent or a personality trait we didn't know we had. What did your little one bring you? Do you agree?
Yeah, housework. No.
That's a gift for the whole family.
yeah, it's true. It's a really good question. I think, like, definitely, I agree. Yeah, I agree that, like, it reveals things about you, and you learn. You have to learn to adapt yourself to who you are, to be there for him. So, like, one, it's a new type of love that, like, you've never experienced before. So that's like the standard thing. But then in terms of, like, a talent, I guess, like, or like a gift or the quality, like, I used to think of myself as a patient person, and I've learned that, like, I'm not. Like, especially with like, he's never been a good sleeper, and at night, and you've got like depressants in you and stuff like that, it can be so easy to, like, not be patient with them. And, like, learning that I it turns out I wasn't really a patient person, and actually, like, what it takes to be patient is like a huge one. So that probably, along with the housework, obviously. I get, if we ever have a second one, learning how to have that love appear from nowhere a second time, and it not impact the love you have for the first one, and then the guilt that maybe you have for the first one as well. Like, I think if we were to have a second, I'm no real worry at the moment, but that would be, like, maybe what it would be for number two. But yeah, I think, like, the patience thing for me, one, that I'm not as patient as I thought I was, but then actually getting that back and learning to be patient all over again. Yeah.
Bit of a journey, isn't it? They don't come with a manual or a how-to guide.
No, and it turns out they're all different from each other as well, which is annoying.
Yeah, true. Very true. Thanks for that. I also, you said something in a very throwaway there, which for me was golden, which is this love like you've never felt before. Mm. And I, like, let's take a moment to think about that. Like, you start this thing and you're like, you know, I'm going to be a parent. I'm going to have this small version of myself to argue with in the future. But, like, what does that mean? That love that you never felt before is so true. And, it, you know, and that's, I don't think that's actually shone, the light's not shone on that. You know, we talk about the practical stuff. We talk about the, you know, the stuff that the outside world can see. You don't necessarily see this huge change which takes place inside you, where your heart doubles in size. Like, you just cannot believe the abundant quality of love that you have for another human. It's pretty special. Our other question is, we would love to know, what are you grateful for in your life right now?
So obviously, you know, usual wife, kid, family members that are supportive, all of that. I think it'll have to be Lyra and my dog. Just, like, she's, as I said, she was there for me when I was going through just the worst time. And, like, if it wasn't for her, I would have sunk into a deep hole, which I'd already kind of had experienced in my past and was desperate to not let happen again. And so therapy obviously helped with that, and she helped with that amazingly. So, yeah, and she's so gentle. She's lovely. She's a Borador, so Border Collie Lab mix. She's so sensitive. She's a little bit scared of my boy because he's 20 months, so he's a bit grabby. But she's, like, we can trust her around him completely. So probably her. But also a shout out to the little jobs where I can switch off, and like washing up or like laundry, hanging out the laundry or doing the cooking, and like I can put on a podcast, and that can be like just little micro moments of me time where I just switch off. Love them as well, because it's full on being a parent, you know. So you need those little moments.
That is really brilliant advice for people as well. Micro moments of me time. It's little micro moments of self-care, isn't it? And we put them into every day and notice them. It makes a huge difference. Oh, brilliant.
And our last one is our kind of take on the guilty feminist. I'm a feminist, but
Yes,
our
yeah.
little guilty confession. So have you got one you'd like to share with us?
This was a really good one. I'm a nutritionist, so say as I do, say, do what I say, not what I do, because like I love a sugar in my tea. Whereas I wouldn't necessarily advise that to people. Well, you know, like maybe a cyclist competing in the Tour de France or something, but outside of that, like incredible calorie burn, maybe not. But in terms of like dad one, I think I was going to say like, I'm a dad, but I don't, that doesn't mean I like your kid. Cause like, but like, you know, if, you know, you take your kid to soft play and then there's a bigger kid and like, they're not looking where they're going and they just knock over your kid. And then you're just like, ah, don't be horrible to my kid. Like kind of thing. But I've recently started, coaching kids football. So I can't really say that I don't like kids. So I think it's just like, I'm a dad, but I don't feel any different to what I did when I was a teenager. Like I feel like I'm the same age as I did when I was a teenager. And it's a little bit like, you know, who thought it was a good idea for me to be a dad? Like I feel the same as I did mentally. So who thought this was a good idea? But you know, you don't notice yourself change over time, do you? But yeah, I would say that. Like I'm a dad, but I feel the same as I did when I was a teenager.
I think I resonate with that, actually. Definitely.
Aren't we all always the same on the inside? I think that's maybe the misconception, is we believe everyone out there has got this whole manual to being a grown-up thing. And one day they wake up and like, I am indeed, in fact, now a grown-up.
Yeah.
I have my mortgage, I've got married, I've had my child, and therefore now I am that person that, you know, I put on that pedestal when I was younger. And I think it's a big day when you realize, okay, so I might be married, I might have the mortgage, I might have the kid, I still don't feel like a grown-up. When does this grown-up feeling hit? I'm reassured by my grandparents that the answer is never. So
we're all figuring it out as we go along.
Definitely, definitely. Let's bust that myth. There are no real grown-ups. love that. Really love that. Thank you so much, Alan. It's just been wonderful.
No, thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Amazing. Thank you.
Pleasure.